This is August the 19th, 1986, and tonight's forum is entitled Tempest in a Teapot, and like most forums, is a chance for people to talk about what's been bubbling up inside of them, the kinds of questions and issues, especially tonight, the kinds of feelings that bubble up within us when the whole matter of feminist God language issues are raised, and when we begin to experience those in the community at Holden. So our resource people are myself, Karen Blomquist, as facilitator, Rosemary Ruther, and Mary Chandler. But we're not really going to say that much. Rosemary's going to just say a few things to provide a kind of framework. But then we're basically going to open it up to you and invite you to share some of your feelings, pro or con, experiences. So it will be an open kind of chance for us together to process through some of that. Rosemary?
Okay, the issue of inclusive language for human beings and even more inclusive language for God is certainly one of the very intense emotional issues in all the Christian churches. Friend and colleague of both Karen and myself, Susan Thistlewaite, was on the Inclusive Language Lectionary of the World National Council of Churches, and she and all the other members of that committee received death threats. These got to be more than just abstract things when she experienced an actual effort to kidnap her children. So, I mean, clearly that there's not only sort of anxiety, there's actually a kind of seething, you know, fear and hostility out there about this, but seems to be generated by this issue. When people come to Holden, they discover that in a sense, a kind of policy has already been adopted, that Holden affirms inclusive language in worship for both humans and deity. At least that's the sheet I received when I was coming here. And yet, certainly many people may not have processed that issue themselves. As someone that talks a lot about that issue in various places, I experience various kinds of reactions. One kind of initial reaction is what I would call the ridicule reaction, which is usually takes the form of something like, "Well, I don't know why this bothers you. It doesn't bother me at all." And then you sort of wonder, there seems to be a slight contradiction between words and body language in this statement. The second kind of reaction is often a kind of attack. And usually I don't get this directly because people don't ever, I usually hear about this indirectly. Somebody will come up to me and say, "Well, you know that this person said that they think that you really want to throw out the Bible completely." And having just, given a whole lecture on the biblical roots, you know, think, how could they have drawn that conclusion? So one experience is kind of attacks coming from sort of indirectly and very often in ways that suggest that people didn't exactly hear what you were trying to say. To me, one gets, and when I hear that, I have the sense that this really isn't a response so much as an effort to silence the question. So what I'd like to suggest as a kind of framework for tonight is that we try to move on to what I see as the third level of discourse, which is to really talk about how we feel about this. And it was not making accusations or judgments, but just say, look, this is what I feel about this. Either that this bothers me, or this is very important to me, or whatever, but that we spend some time, not at first asking questions so much, as just let people talk about what the issue means to them. And then we'll try to interact with that. So that's how we're proposing to start off.
So the floor is open.
Right. Ohio Missouri Synod, I've been largely unaware of it until I came here, and it total surprise to me, totally. And I just
What started what?
The feminist. It's new for me.
I think what we've asked people to do is to say how you feel about it. So what I would ask you to do is to say what you feel about it.
What do I feel about it?
Yeah.
I'm really struggling with it. It's very difficult for me to accept.
Could you tell us why?
No, I'm thinking about it. It's very hard for me to say why at this point, except I don't understand why. And I don't even know what it's all about. It's so new. I came here on Saturday. And it's
I think I understand why, but it still doesn't seem natural to me to not say all of God. The feeling and the cognitive aren't together for me. That's the struggle that I have.
Would you be willing to unpack that a little bit? I mean, if you could say the cognitive and...
When you think about inclusive language, it makes sense. The feminine gender has been excluded since the words were written. And it seems not fair, not correct. It shouldn't have been that way. And so that means that since I've been thinking that way since I grew up, I should change. But it's being hard for me to do. So I guess it's a struggle to work at listening to liturgy that's inclusive and not reacting. You know, I know that I should accept that, but I don't, and that's the struggle within me.
I guess I'm really interested in the second part, because I guess that's where I don't, since I have exactly the opposite feelings.
Okay.
But I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's important to try to unpack what those feeling dimensions are.
I have an example. You know, you're raised with that, you know, from this fall on, or this little on. Yeah, so you have that natural, you know, like good Christian men rejoice, you know, the Christmas song, you know, the whole thing. But I was really offended last fall when I saw, I'm a social worker, and there was something new issued, you know, a new format to follow for something at work. And it got down and it said, the social worker will give his report. Okay, you know, that offended me. And, you know, I think there's a parallel here. Because I wasn't taught that social workers are key. And I'm offended when I'm excluded. I'm offended when I'm excluded. It said RN will give her report, and we had a male RN, and you know, so we both said, we don't fit, and we're not going to say anything.
I understand what you mean when you say that it feels odd, because it does, but I like the oddness because it reminds me of something very exciting. I mean, it's a sort of a jarring, like, hey, yeah, right, me too. And so every time those words feel odd to me, it feels good.
But I wonder to what extent the move towards inclusive language can become a permanent one if what happens for many of us is that it's a jarring effect. If it ceases to be jarring, will it cease to be necessary? In Vespers last night, the feminine pronoun her was used in reference to God. And for most of us, that's jarring. That goes against the traditions we're used to. If that ceases to be jarring, does it cease to matter? Or will we revert to, which is what's happening in my discipline in English, in composition and writing, will we revert to a kind of traditionalism, saying the language fails us. The language doesn't give us a decent alternative. That's, I guess, what...
Are you? I mean, I guess I have a hard time understanding how the inclusion of women would just, we say, oh, well, we've done that.
No, we'll just
go back to using all male language?
Not the inclusion of women, but the inclusion of feminine pronouns specifically in a non-traditional situation. Is it something that, because it jars us, is important now. If it ceases to jar us, I'm wondering, will it continue to be
pertinent? Well, I mean, I'm assuming that what jars women is the lack of female genders.
I would respond to that from a somewhat, it sounds like I have a somewhat different experience. To begin with, I'm a Baptist, which puts me in a different field than many of you. But I come from a corner of the Baptist Church that has used inclusive language for years. And I find myself, as the woman shared earlier, that when I get back among people who are not using inclusive language, I find that jarring. And so part of the process is when you get used to it, I mean, it does become a part of the language. I also have an interest in the English language, and I think some of the methods that are being used for inclusion are very awkward, because our language does fail us. But one of the realities of English is that it's one of the most adaptable languages, and what is awkward for us now will eventually evolve into some forms that we may not even have conceived of as yet. But because of the concern for inclusiveness and because of the willingness of some people to deal with the awkwardness now, we make those steps towards the change in the language that will ultimately allow that to happen smoothly. So I think you do get used to it. And I have heard some good ways of doing it. I've heard some bad ways of doing it. And part of it is just the more you hear it, the more you are able to cope with it.
Any other feelings, yeah?
I think I would be jarred if it were strictly male language. I think I found jarring the first day. And even today, I'd say I'm struggling with it, was a real active exclusion of what you call the sort of male hierarchical. So that explicitly never using Lord, which to me has a lot of relevant theological connotations, is very perplexing. Or I guess what I feel is, well, I'm at Holden for a week and we'll suspend good theology. You know, that somehow that's, you know, okay, I guess for a week we can just not deal with those dominion aspects of God or the transcendent or all of those things that occur, so that Lord will leave out of the lexicon. But I do find that jarring.
Well, you'll be happy to note that is the most popularly used language for God in the OBW by far. But you want even for the next most popular, which is King.
Lord?
Yes.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure that's why it's jarring, because it's the one that's most commonly used. And I guess I don't think it was until someone contrasted Lord and Lady that I thought of it as being particularly gender related, unlike Father, which is quite clearly gender related. Nor did I, do I think of it as kind of the things Rosemary's been talking about with sort of lords. If lords have power, then the people under them don't have power. I think there are good lords in a good kingdom. That for me, that is not a word that's a particularly loaded one. And so I find it a little bit jarring not to ever be sort of permitted to use it.
So that's getting us into another area, I think. Gender language, but then how that connects with power language.
Yeah. And that I appreciated in your comments, uh-huh. The power language relationships.
Uh-huh. Others, yeah?
I really came lately to the whole inclusive language idea. I think it started back in 1980 at Holden. And I kept saying, why? There were three or four feminists on teaching staff at one time. And I thought, why is everybody getting so upset about the fact that we don't use inclusive language? People are dying all over the world. Our kids are on drugs. You know, I kept naming all of these things where people were oppressed until someone, a few good women friends of mine, said, I really feel oppressed by the language we use. It hurts me. I have a hard time worshiping. And just like we don't like to think of ourselves as racist, we are part of a racist society and involved in it. And I didn't. That was the first time when I really was interested in starting to look at inclusive language, when I realized that some people really hurt because they do not feel included. And we had a particularly bad hymn about a month ago out of the LBW. In Adam, In Adam, all men are some. I mean, it's just, except for one verse, it was just really very strongly in male language. And I went up to our pastor afterwards and said, I just want to protest your choice of that hymn today. It was very hard for me to sing, and I get really upset that you don't try to choose hymns that are more inclusive. And he said, well, I really get upset with people who can't adjust. And he's a very loving pastor, so it was a very strange comment for him to make. But he really felt strongly, and he said, why are you so bothered by that? It didn't bother me at all.
I kept thinking of, and I was the one that came up with that really catchy novel title, Tempest in a Teapot, question mark.
I thought it was supposed to be a cup.
Oh, is it?
Teacup?
Teacup. Teacup. Well,
that makes it even smaller.
And I kept thinking of that language that all children remember and then we forget as adults, but it's handed up from generations of children to children. Sticks and stones may break my bones.
But names will never break your
bones. Okay. Well, so I think sometimes we bring that approach to liturgy and language, that we think that, well, it's not really a minor, you know, it is a minor issue and it doesn't matter. And of course, I'm always imaging a fully, profoundly, either imageless or totally image-full God when I pray. And of course, generic male means male and female. And yet, one of the most intriguing things that I've discovered, first from my own personal experience, I discovered that was wrong, but also I work part-time in a women's shelter as a volunteer. And I'm sort of their woman knight on a white charger. When they occasionally, I normally just work as a volunteer, but when there's a woman who comes in who has been tangled up in a particular theological system, which is harmful to her, I get come in and give her some alternatives. And about, oh, 5 or 6 months ago, I got called in this capacity, and I knew that the woman was a member of a fundamentalist sect, and knew that she was having some problems because she really felt that the male language she heard was real language and that God was male and that both her pastor who spoke for God and her husband who was God in her life had certain rights because of the male gender language. So I managed to get upstairs and so I was in a room with her and she had one black eye. And was already feeling guilty. They rush out usually and then within 2 days the guilt starts back in. Shouldn't I go back? Shouldn't I be submissive? Can't I behave well enough to make it better? And she had just come into a fundamentalist Baptist church, there are not fundamentalist Baptist churches. And she had just been baptized. She was in the mid-30s. She had no ecclesial experience whatsoever of any other church, so she couldn't like pick and choose. And she could say, well, here's the LCA on one side, here's the Methodists here. This was her only experience of community and of God. And what she is being told with Bible verses, and she had the Bible there, you know, right there. And I knew immediately I wasn't going to be listened to because I was a woman, you know, quoting verses at me. And so I said, fine, I'm not trying to change your belief system as such, but I need to tell you what happened in terms of some things in the last few years and that even within the Baptist church there are other understandings. So I just gave her some choices. She thought if she stayed away from her husband, this was the second time she left him, she was not going to be blessed by God. She would never be able to be a member of the Christian community again. She would have the guilt of what happened to her children as they grew up. And so I just gave her some choices and I said, you tell me if you want to believe in a God that's going to give you another black eye. But it was that she had just heard the male language and she thought and was told that it was male. And so I hooked her up with a American Baptist Conference male pastor from Berkeley. We hang out together and sent her over to him so he could reinforce the same kind of thing. But it sticks and stones do break our bones, but words can too. And it makes me very careful of realizing the connection between the two.
But it's clearly not the language. I mean, the language is the symptom or the surface manifestation of something else. The example that you gave, the discussion earlier on power, if you simply change the language but don't examine the assumptions underlying the language, you're not going to get anywhere. I assume we're talking just about the language tonight.
No, I'm assuming we're talking about the assumptions underneath the language, too. I mean, clearly the assumptions underneath that kind of male language, I mean, they're obviously males that don't give people black eyes, so, I mean, there's a certain assumption about maleness in relationship to power as domination and punishment and so on. That's that for which maleness is construed as a particular kind of relationship.
The language is the tip of the iceberg, but not an insignificant part of that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we'll probably move to that. If you're still on how do we feel, I thought that you asked about the tip of the iceberg as the first sharing. I feel that there are some more awkward times than others, and it's anything that's different kind of calls your attention. But I think the primary feeling I have is that we are moving toward better clarity. And I think that's important. I think language is important. And I don't think it was clear. And I'm in favor of clarity of language. That's kind of my temperament and my interest. And so when it means all people, I hope we say all people. And when we mean men or women, I want clarity. And the reason I like the female and male images for God and have both used is it's clarifying, because in the old of never having a variety, I think we really got unclear and forgot it was a metaphor. And I just think that's very dangerous for us to forget it's a metaphor.
Yeah.
So I'm glad for a variety so that we're clear on that.
Can I just respond a minute? As most of you are aware, I teach at Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago, and for this next year, just this points to, I think, the significance of the kind of thing that John is suggesting. For this next year, instead of having our weekly faculty colloquies where one of the faculty members shares some current scholarship, the total faculty energy for this time, is for this whole year, is being spent on the issue of God language from various disciplinary perspectives. And so underlying premise of devoting a whole year to this is that the challenges that have especially come from a feminist critique, although from some other circles too, are raising up so many of the fundamental issues connected with our God language and power relationships and the theology and church history and biblical tradition, etc., that's something that the total faculty needs to devote its energy. So we're going to have 8 of us are going to be presenting major papers, and the idea is it will be eventually a book with everybody on the faculty in the act in terms of respondents. And so I'm not saying that as wow, look what we're doing kind of thing, because there's certainly mixed feelings on this, and we can get into very emotional discussions on that faculty. But nevertheless, seeing that the feminist critique has become, as one of my colleagues says, kind of like an umbrella that is forcing us to rethink the whole gamut of theological disciplines, biblical, church history, the whole kind of, the whole ball of wax, or the whole umbrella. And I think that's kind of exciting, that there's that sense that hey, some of these issues that haven't been talked about for a long time really come to the fore, and not just in terms of gender language, but the very nature of what our God language and imagery is all about. So anyway, that's just something to say, hey, it is a whole iceberg that we're talking about.
Yeah?
I'm an English teacher, so I have an investment in clarity in language, and I care a lot about how people use it, because I really believe that what you think affects language, but language affects what you think. And in fact, yeah, it may be that language is, when they may be the same thing. And so if you give people this most important tool, and you give them flawed, it's awful. They need the best tool that they can, so you can think that.
Yeah?
This is kind of interesting. My field of speech communication, it sounds as if we could have a sizable group. What do you say after this? We can all go out in the side room and diagram sentences.
Well, you can do the Liturgy Friday and see how it is.
One of the things we used to say is the greatest impediment to communication is the illusion that it has taken place. And, if you've ever walked into an elevator and stood there and thought, gee, this feels funny, and then realized that it feels funny because your right foot is on some lady's toe and she's been long-suffering about it, think how embarrassed you'd be. And you might have gotten used to it, but perhaps. Seriously, I believe that we should all remind ourselves that meaning is not in words, meaning is in people. And if somebody's getting hurt, that's reason enough. Now, I'm a Catholic, and I was one of those people who used to fight for the vernacular movement. I remember telling more than one priest.
What that means.
I'm dating myself. But okay. This will help. I remember telling one priest that I'd really take him seriously about Latin being the universal language when he started to read the bingo announcements. And I noticed here yesterday, or the day before, when we were going to sing the songs, that when they said choir part, there was a mark for the choir part, and for the women, there was a mark for that, for the men, there was a mark for that. I think if you ask somebody, you say, now we're going to say man, but we really mean every, you know, we really mean everybody. Well, it's hard, and I've had to make the same accommodations as everybody else has, but isn't it worth making it? How much longer shall we stand on that woman's toe?
Yeah.
I think to me the hard part, though, is, you know, in some ways I would agree, and in certain ways, say if it's the talking about Adam and the hymns seem to be very male-oriented or something. But the ones I feel I have the trouble with is the Lord and the Father. Those are the hard ones, and to me my feeling of what those mean is not going to be changed really if I call them. But it's still hard to change.
You mean losing them?
Changing the terms, I'm not sure that that's going to, maybe it will affect the way in which I think about them, feeling toward them, but at least for the immediate time, it's hard to change those two things. It's not hard to change the other things, and I guess I get offended when it says, fill out his report or something like that. I don't run across that very often, but I would be offended at that too. But somehow it's different when we're talking about Lord and Father.
Do you feel when Mother takes equal place and you still have Father, are you still feeling a loss? Or are you feeling some gain to camp next then?
I guess I don't feel a real gain in changing those two. Yes, I feel a gain in changing the others.
Is there a problem in adding two? Because I think all three of us are not saying we need to sanitize our tradition and avoid Father references to God, but adding two, so it's not.
You're not requiring that we're only at home.
Just you don't have to answer this. It is a fairly personal question, but did you have a fairly good relationship with your Father when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah.
I noticed in the women's children movement, there are some women and children who come in who have been sexually abused by their fathers and their brothers from the time they're 2 or 3 years old, and they just can't click that together. And to be able then to say, you can see God as Mother. You know, maybe at the end of 40 years of psychotherapy, you might say, ideally it'd be wonderful if this woman who has been abused for 22 years can't again go back into Father images of God, but at least in terms of a pastoral kind of situation, I'm really happy that happened. I know a lot of men can't relate to Father and can relate to Mother. And it, whatever way I think that can lead us to that kind of gentleness and holding and embracing. And it might have to be through one or the other in a particular situation.
Yeah, I think what's being suggested here, obviously, is that we bring a lot of personal experiences, particularly the parent language, whether Mother... or Father, and that I think can work different ways. I mean, in some cases, the lack of a good father in your own personal experiences may mean that Father language for God becomes a kind of compensation. In which this is, as Diane Tennis says in her book, is God the only reliable father? Which the lack of experiences of good fathers. And of course, she argues for the keeping of father language, although not exclusive father language.
What gender will have
to be? Come on, speak for yourself, Ozzy. One can unpack the whole kind of complex emotional connections between actual experiences of parents and the way parent language strikes you for God. Yeah?
I'm going to go back to something I said earlier in fall, because I thought that you were saying we'll go beyond the tip of the iceberg to some of the meaty parts.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I, in fact, am concerned if, along with doing this, God doesn't have dominion in some areas. And I hear that out of some sets of reactions to this that we, and I, that just happens to be my theological traditionalism. Fear, love, and trust God is part of the picture, and there are some things there. This is a God of judgment. This is a God of wrath. This is a God of power who sustains and upholds. I mean, it's a very rich image of sustaining, but it is also one that's got something more than my own empowerment going on in it. And I guess that's where I'm concerned when I hear where you eliminate the Lord language or some of those things that you're, that then becomes a distortion of its own. It's not bad in all times and all places, and certainly the woman over there doesn't need to worry about fearing God right now. But I think,
I think that's an important issue. And before you said dominion and transcendence, and you know, we could talk about those probably in separate ways. I have some concern, at least in some of the things I've done, it's a matter of saying, hey, we maybe need to rethink how we talk about transcendence. Because, yeah, I want to continue to think of God as a transcendent God, not just an immanent kind of God. And I think, you know, your feelings there are accurate in that much of the references and images and depictions of God that feminists use is very immanental. You know, I have some colleagues who say, well, it's too, you know, just an immanental God that creeps in.
Well, but I'm much more comfortable with the God language than I am with then this set of other argumentation that's sort of an extension. In other words, it's like I bought into being, you know, certainly we went the other night, we're talking about creator, sustainer, you know, advocate, particularly with therapy, a whole set of very nurturing kinds of things, but at almost an exclusion of that other dimension. A lack of clarity, then.
I mean, to me, transcendence is very important because if God is reduced to supporting the world as it is, we're in trouble. But the question for me then is not no transcendence, but rather how transcendence is modeled, and is it a transcendence that essentially is world fleeing and world rejecting, or is it a kind of opening up of our true possibilities? So I mean, all those kind of things for me are involved in how you relate things like transcendence and dominion and so on. Yeah.
I think this is a similar point, and I think Karen's book, the year that Mary talked about up here at Holden, we really worked at language, and I thought it was very good for the whole community to do it. And it was in the winter. In some ways, that's easier for a community here in the winter to choose to do that, because you're not kind of jarring people who are here for a very brief time. I felt that it was a very healthy year. The thing I had the most trouble with is some people push for language that would never refer to God in language other than eternal flame, or language that, for me, for instance, the one Lord, the language of calling Jesus Lord. Historically, I think that is the first creedal statement, Jesus is Lord. And for me, it was an alternative to saying Caesar is Lord. I don't want to lose that political affirmation of Jesus as the Lord of my life and make eternal flame instead of that. So that what I'm interested in.
Is that an imagery of flame?
The essential element of this discussion, namely humor.
that is difficult to take a historic moment when the choosing of Jesus is Lord was what you said at baptism. In fact, if I understand correctly, you went down into the water, and before you did, you turned to the west. If you were in the Holy Land, you turned toward Rome, and in essence, gave a rag toward Rome. Went into the water and came out and said, Jesus is Lord. It's very hard to have new language.
When you're in Rome, you just do that over again.
Picks up the spirit of that. It's the same way with if Father really was a breakthrough of intimacy, Abba, rather than remoteness, what I want language to be able to do is to pick that up with other ways, female, mommy, or whatever it is, and those all kind of jar us because we've gotten used to the other. But I think you said I don't want to sanitize it or something. I'd like to keep the dimensions of what those metaphors were, expand them, but not lose them by being afraid of an image that might offend or something.
Add to them in order to accentuate or bring up what those original references were intended to convey.
Right.
Yeah, the inclusive language lectionary, some of you, are you familiar with what they tried to do on that? Well, they very much picked up on the underlying political meaning of the term Jesus is Lord, but they attempted to make it sort of a neutral generic by substituting the word sovereign, but in a way that they saw as very much emphasizing the notion that Jesus is our sovereign, as we have an allegiance to Jesus in a way that frees us from allegiance to the powers, the principalities, the Caesars, and so on. And so they were attempting not to do away with, but in fact to sort of recover that meaning. I think the problem was, and this is, I think, part of the function of language, however much the term Lord may originate in the English language, of course, for actual, you know, nobles and so on like that, male nobles, the actual use of language creates a whole kind of personalism and intimacy with a word like Jesus is Lord, for which the word sovereign has no such feeling, overtones, undertones, and so on. I mean, it just sort of slaps you in the me in the face like a cold fish, the word sovereign. I always think of sort of a gold coin kind of ringing on the table. My Canadian friends all laughed heartily and said that they thought of a sovereign as distant, female, and impotent. So, I mean, I think part of the problem with these kind of committee changes is that you don't get at the whole emotional content of words. You're just kind of intellectually saying this is the meaning, and now we make a generic version of that and so on. And it's interesting, it's the black churches that absolutely put their foot down. We're not getting rid of Lord. Because this for us is the liberating word. I mean, it's Jesus' Lord that liberates you from us, all you white lords, you know. So they were very clear that that word had a whole kind of dimension to it. So for me, the key thing here is not to sort of knock out important language, but rather to bring in other dimensions. And that's why I always push for pluralism of possibilities rather than this sort of one, you know, correct word that now becomes the new correct word. Yeah?
I've been using inclusive language for 8 years, and I feel, you know, totally at home with inclusive language. But what I do have a problem with is in the use of the word both he and she for God, because I think if we use he, we are excluding the females. If we use she, we are excluding the males. And I wish that we could, I mean, I just plain say God, you know, or, you know, maybe there can be some other terms, but I don't want to start excluding men because we're using she. And I feel that, I felt that the other night, you know, in the church service when we said she for God, I thought, there they go, only using half again. I mean, you know, or is it half? I don't know. You know, maybe it's not any part of God. I don't know. I mean, God has all these characteristics, and I don't like hearing she just as I don't like hearing him.
You know, it's very difficult. You know, you've got two genders and one God, so, I mean, it's this problem. And particularly the English language doesn't provide a inclusive personal pronoun in the third person. One of the interesting things is that is by doing first second person language, you can sort of avoid a lot of it. If you say we you, which of course in some ways is a more appropriate language of prayer, you can rather than talking about God sort of in the third person. So that's one kind of way of
I think
kind of
really
trying to avoid that. I think grammatical problem.
I think that the language is very much imagery, and that we need both images of God, both male and female, that God holds both characteristics, and that God is Father and God is Mother, that we our goal should not be to exclude either one, but to use that imagery to try to understand better the different aspects of God.
I joined a church about a year ago that had a woman pastor, and that was the reason I joined it, because I'd come from the Catholic tradition where one would have to go to another century to have this experience.
Which century?
I don't know yet. I might wait. I can't anymore. And it was very interesting for me to reflect on that. It's so powerful at first, and wonderful and exciting. And then about 6 months later, my family didn't always come with me. We have sort of like a peripatetic benign cynic and a couple of Catholics in the teenage years, and then the youngest is Lutheran now. And it was only until after the service that my family said something about having, at that particular service, both the, obviously the pastor and the, I get confused with the Lutheran terminology. Lay assistant and the acolyte were all female, and I thought, how wonderful! I don't notice anymore. And it was like when I got to the point where I could look back and say, well, of course, if there were two or three men up there, it wouldn't have mattered. Or some Sunday it turned out that there were three women. I think maybe with the language of she and he, that right now we really sort of hear it all, but when we get to the point where maybe we can, we're not sitting there counting out, like a little rosary bead, Lutheran version. Okay, well, that's 17 he's and 62 she's. We're going to have to balance it up next week. So we can, that we hear them both and we aren't sort of guarding our turf or more. And I think that's the sign when we can say, good, we've gotten somewhere now. And we're just not there yet.
Yeah.
I think, and it's been talked about, but I think sometimes we talk about this as if you just kind of benignly add to those other images, and that just doesn't happen. You add feminine images to God, and that's a reinterpretation. Then a Lord no longer can have the same exclusive, connotations. That any time you expand, then it also reinterprets, I think. There's just that process going on. And that is, again, I think, what is the threat. If you make it sound like, well, sure, you can still keep your Lord, but you're not going to keep your Lord if your Lord is also a suckling mother. That Lord gets reinterpreted by those new metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what, sometimes I think we portray it as if you can keep those, and that's fine, and it's all the same. But it's not going to be all the same if you start adding some new. And that's very threatening. I mean, it's those images of exclusive male and Lord that are taken to the extreme, that are perverted, and that gets us in the whole power schemes and God justification of our wars and our, and all of that. You couldn't do that if you had those same Lords and all that, but...
This is in fact why inclusive language is important to me. It's precisely that not only is what sort of, as Mary Hunt puts it, add women and stir kind of thing. And then you just have kind of the same cookie mix with some women in it.
Or chocolate chips.
but I mean, if the to me the exclusive word Father for God is paterfamilias. That's a hierarchical model in which women, children, and slaves are subordinate. When you say father and mother, you have a whole different model. You have parents as co-parents and as partners. I mean, it's a whole shift of the dynamic. That's for me very part of what I try to unpack in terms of
the implications too. The fact that what that's also brought to us is a reminder that it's metaphor, which is threatening if we were speaking in terms of some kind of ultimate reality of father in the hierarchy, and we had that all figured out nice and neatly, and now it's suddenly metaphor again, and that's very threatening because now you're dealing with, it's very liberating, and now we can talk about other metaphors that aren't just anthropocentric or God as creation kinds of metaphors and water metaphors and all sorts of beautiful metaphors of life-giving.
Yeah, I think the notion that there is a kind of direct, univocal relationship between the Word and God is a very kind of, it's a part of a security system. And when you start fuzzing that and saying we only, this is only a metaphor. We don't control God with our words, and you know, compass God's reality. Then that's a whole. I think that's very unsettling. I was
transcendence, right?
Yeah. Right. Let me say a little bit more about Susan Thistlewaite and the death threats. She probably got more of the death threats than any. Well, I think the women got in general more than the men on this, and it was an interesting experience. Interesting, sort of a mild term, because the women and the blacks I think were all black men on the lectionary committee were not really surprised at this emotional dimension. I mean, it was a little more threatening than they expected, but they weren't surprised. The thing that the people who were shocked were the white males on the committee, because they had literally never experienced, I mean, they that kind of hostility toward themselves at all. They had just, I mean, from their point of view, they were doing good exegesis. This was what they'd been trained to do. And then all of a sudden, you know, death threats, you know, to me for my scholarship, you know. I could hardly believe it. I mean, it was a very, and it was actually a very transforming experience. I mean, the lectionary committee became a kind of suffering community, you know, in a very interesting way. I mean, it knit that group of people together, and some of those, the white men discovered their colleagues refusing to speak to them. I mean, there was a whole another dimension that they hadn't expected at all. But Susan got, a lot of them got a lot of letters. Susan got quite a few, and she decided, she got a grant at the same time to do some study on violence to women. And she hadn't expected language and violence to women to connect so closely. So she decided to actually read all these letters to see what underneath the anger was the fear. And what she got out of reading those letters is that the fear was a sense of a whole security system being shaken up. It was that the concept of God as Father Lord was really a concept that the universe is under control. God is in heaven, the universe is under control. And that to shake up that, and they tend to, well, I mean, even, and of course, they didn't do away with father language, they added mother and father. But that was, for the people who are hearing that, a mother added to a father indeed should completely change that line of control. And they immediately saw, you know, all kinds of rabble, you know, running amok in the streets and crime and all kinds of chaos breaking out, which of course they're already breaking out. But I mean, that was it. There was a very clear connection between a certain kind of lordship language and their notion of keeping reality under control. So she found, I mean, she was surprised at how sort of clear that connection was in these letters. I don't know. She didn't tell me the gender breakdown of these letters. I suspect both.
Personally, it would probably be anonymous. I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. I've, the type of letter, I don't get too many hostile letters. Surprisingly enough, I think women write not enough in popular media. But I can always recognize a certain kind of letter because it's written in a sort of large. Printed type, and their words are underlined in different colors and something like that. And you know, as soon as you see that letter, you know it's going to be, you know, I hate you and hope you go to hell, you bitch. You know, it's going to be that kind of a letter.
Back there.
I'm not sure that it's always the what is behind the language that's upsetting people. I mean, I've been in churches where they want to sing the familiar hymns, they don't want new hymns, and they don't want the pews moved, thank you. You know, they're really not upset about the idea of feminine image of God as much as this is their service that they're familiar with, and that's the way they like it.
Yeah, I think that's a very real issue, which means that one of the things we need to consider is the whole process of change and how one affects change, whether it's on this issue or other issues. And I think that's where, you know, I'm having to continually caution some of our seminarians who are, you know, really determined to go out there and change all and say, hey, you know, it's probably going to take a good long time.
I personally am not offended by language. I am offended if I'm in a church and I'm told that that I cannot serve on the council, or that I cannot help serve communion, or that I cannot help with the scripture reading or do a sermon. That is upsetting to me, much more so than the language that's been used.
Karen? But sometimes isn't that thing of saying, I want what's familiar, just a way of saying, you know, blocking out and saying, I'm not going to change. These are the concepts. It can be a defense, and one way of a defense of saying, I learned it this way, and it's going to be this way. You know, it's like, you know, King James Version. I'm not going to get the RSV. If the King James Version is good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for you.
So we are really facing a very basic theological issue. Does change the categories change the
language? I mean, isn't that a sort of a security issue, too? I mean, the religion plays a sense that that's the immutable, unchangeable, secure thing. I mean, in a world that's all in turmoil, this is the secure place. And so any kind of change is a sense that that's...
I'm interested to know the next step that will come after this. Are we going to, you're speaking of God the Father or God our Mother. Now, does Jesus then become our sister? I know you laugh, but is that the next step? Yeah.
Well, I think that the inclusive, do you want me to tell you what the Inclusive Language Lectionary did? I mean, for them it was very... the theological point was that God is not male or female, and can be image in both images, and so you use inclusive language for God. You don't use inclusive language for a male human being any more than you use, male language for a female human being. So Jesus, as a human being, is male, and so when it's referring to him as a human being, they always use male language for him. But I think the important shift is that one doesn't confuse his human maleness with the maleness of God. And so they attempted to distinguish those two things. And when it's referring to the Christ in the sense of the experience of God in him, they would use more inclusive language. But for him as a human being, they would always use male language any more than the same as a female in the story would be referred to as a female language. And one of the things that they did, however, which many people thought of as changing the gender of persons in the story, but actually simply reflected a more accurate reading of the text. Many of the parables or stories that are about, let's say, a blind person, and we've been used to hearing the word a blind man, and so our image of that was a blind man. But the word in the Greek is simply the generic word for a human being, anthropos. And so whenever there was a story about a person referred to as anthropos, but no other word in that story said whether that was a male or a female person, they would use in those cases they said a blind person came to Jesus. And for many people that was sort of jarring because they had been used to thinking of that as a male. But then when there was any specific naming of that person as a male, then they would say, amen. But that's just simply a question of being more specific about what is actually said there.
Let me just add to that I think some of us find, and maybe have gone through a period where, there have been some real struggling with Jesus' maleness becoming then somehow normative. Nevertheless, I think there's a way of looking at Jesus and the way in which he broke with a lot of the patriarchal expectations of his day, and therefore suggested a much different way of being male in that society than some of the prevailing notions. I don't want to push that too far. Some of our Jewish friends would say, he was coming out of a culture where that was more mixed and it wasn't always that heavily patriarchal either. So I think there can be something very freeing in the fact that he, as a male, did what he did in that particular society. So the maleness of Jesus certainly is not something that I'm wanting to deny or cover up or whatever. But again, as Rosemary is saying, if we try to somehow then make that essential to who God is, that's what
or essential to who Christ is, because basically I think what we need to add is that the Christ moves from Jesus as announcer to the community, and that community is where the Christ is present in our brothers and sisters. So I think that it's that loss of there's a kind of isolation of Jesus as the Christ that turns maleness into a kind of norm.
We need to ascend to the heights for a question or two up here.
You're talking about the feelings and changes of feelings. I resonated to the concern of because some people are offended by this, therefore I should relate, I should begin to respond to this. And that's a legitimate concern, but I think there's, I've sensed to myself a movement away from that kind of position, that I was not being a gentleman and bowing to the lady's concerns by doing inclusive language, but that inclusive language has become more for me something that is of great value to me. It's not something I'm doing for somebody else. The images that I'm receiving of God are much bigger. I'm a little insecure about some of the movement, but the God that comes to me out of this whole thing is a bigger God, and it's exciting. I possess the desire to see this happen for myself now. And so when I have someone in my parish say, well, I'm a woman and I don't feel that need, I say, well, I feel that need. Now, not I'm doing it for somebody else. And because if I don't own it myself, it's hard for me to be motivated.
Yeah, I think that's very, very exciting and important. And I think that's part of what I, and it's very much why I object to getting, you know, just doing a shift and focusing on female language, because I think part of the point here is to expand the humanity of both men and women. And a kind of stereotypic male language has also been a truncating language for males.
I know there are still hands, so I'm hoping some of you will stay around and continue the discussion, but let's officially finish the forum for now, and if you want to continue to discuss, we can do that.
Pardon? You have to go
elsewhere. Yes, I have.
She has to go
elsewhere.
Okay, well, this is...
Okay, this
is... She's had her hand up for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah. I know how you teach this image to a child. How you what? Teach the image to a child. That's what's going to happen.
Which image?
Okay. You know, we all have father image, and if you have a bad father image, then your image of God has not been good.
But I guess I mean, the child doesn't start out with the presuppositions of always hearing no language anyway. Yeah, well, I guess what I'm saying is that the new child hasn't heard the father language, and so it you know, what could start out with something that's much more appropriate to the child's experience, which is that parents come in two genders, and that we think of God as like a mother and father, and so on. I don't think that's... I would use abstractions like parents. I would say God is like a mother and a father, and so on. And it seems to me that's so obvious. I mean, if the child has both parents. I mean, I guess what one discovers is that the children are fastened to death because they haven't had the previous conditions. Yeah?
The one thing about the discussion that really bothered me is that we've been talking about it, although it was alluded to, we acted as if the people who were jarred, it's just a matter of getting used to it, or you know, some people's feelings were slightly hurt. But you know very well from your own work that behind the change in language is a whole, potentially a whole program of rethinking the theology. And so this is not, well, I mean, it's not merely a matter of people can be offended or take issue with it for political and economic and religious reasons, which are profound, that have nothing to do with simply being wedded to, on the surface, being comfortable with father or always hearing it a particular way. And there was something slightly disingenuous about treating the objection to the language as merely being problems of fundamentalists or people who write large letters or...